a vineyard Solomon owned in Baal Hamon. And the man who guards the vineyard gives for its fruit as a reward 1,000 silver pieces. That is our scripture for today, little children, from Song of Songs, chapter 8, verse 11, from the Ward Green translation of 2003. That's going to become important when we read tomorrow's verse. We see what the importance is of the 1,000 compared to the amount received by the workers of the vineyard, which is going to be the essential basis for what people receive today when they represent someone. It's going to be a very similar percentage that we see that, for example, when artists have an agent, right? When a recording artist has an agent or a performing artist has an agent, the agent gets a percentage, and we're going to see what that is. The basis of that may well have originated in the Bible, as we'll see tomorrow. Now, yesterday we were studying the Ark of Urar to the Orient Express, chapter 4, paragraph 1. And in that paragraph, there was a table which gives all the details of what the different numbers are, which can be used as the date of the Tower of Babel. And all those numbers we average to get 2737. Each one of them is listed there with the source, the method, of course, and the source is also given on the right. Now, what's Mr. Smith's from? Do we have a reference? There it is, the Patriarchal Age. That's the work of Mr. Smith. I'm trying to find out what his name is. His first name, Mr. Smith. He's a very well-known author. Smith writes, if it's the same Smith, he writes a number of things. Okay, where is he here? Patriarchal Age, here he is. George Smith, yeah, that sounds right. George Smith, an author of ancient history and things like that. Now we're going to begin reading paragraph 2 of chapter 4 of the Ark of Urartu. As Mr. Cornazzi drew on the wisdom of Abu Faragi for his book, we have likewise found 2741 BCE, an estimate for the date of the dispersion at the Tower of Babel. That's the last entry in Table 5 there, Abu Faragi. From the 541 years of this same Armenian Catholicos. Who is the Armenian Catholicos? Is it Abu Faragi or Mr. Cornazzi? That's what that makes me wonder. The eclipse of Nimrod is 541 years before 2233 BCE. Well, that's another interesting thing. The eclipse of Nimrod is also 541 years before 2233, which it was 541 years after the deluge, which was 3282, and that brought us to 2741. But from the eclipse of 2774, when we go back 541 years, we get to 2233. But also, so that's another 541. But also 8 times 541 years and some months. Um, the eclipse of Nimrod is before 1556. That I can't do in my head. Let's see if we can do that. Let's see. 8 times 5, 41. Minus 15, 56. 27, 72. Yeah. Well, that's going to be, it's going to be plus 1. Because there's no year 0. That's 27, 73. Plus, because of the month difference, it's going to be end up being that number of years and some months before the date of July 2774, because this earthquake occurred in January in 1556 CE, of which year, in January of which year, there was an earthquake in the Shanxi province of China, the deadliest earthquake known, that killed about 830,000 people. 830,000 people in China on that morning. The number 541 is a prime number. This number that we've been, finding out about there, with some properties that bear mentioning, it is a centered 12-gonal number. It is a centered 15-gonal number, centered 36-gonal number, and is the number of orderings of 5 objects with ties allowed. We have adopted, as have others before us, the association of the Tower of Babel to the dividing during Peleg's days, and the synchronization to any years of Nimrod is natural. Several methods of evaluating either the time of the tower or the time of Nimrod may now be compared from Table 5, which we've already presented above. The midpoint of the high and low dates is 2741, or the same as the date computed from the 541 years after the deluge, the last value in the table accredited to Abu Faragi. I guess he's the one who is the Armenian Catholicos. 2753, which is the top number there, the highest date, 2753. And 2729 is the lowest. The average of the highest and lowest is usually given a name, I think, but let's see, is it called, there are different names for these different types of averages. This is not the mean value, but it's some kind of average value of the highest and lowest in this case. And it's midway between the highest and lowest, and it's 2741, which is 12 years below 2753 and 12 years above 2729, right? And then we have Table 6 also. Well, we'll talk about that some other day, maybe. I haven't had time to look at this, but this is another interesting thing that comes about from factors of 7. From the birth of Shem to the death of Solomon. It's 20. So it's 7 to the 4th years equals 2401. 7 to the power of 4. I remember this now. Okay, 2401 is 7 to the power of 4, as shown there. You just say 7 times 7 times 7 times 7. That's 4 times multiplied with itself, and that's 2401. Okay, that number of years is almost a round number, but not quite. But it's the time between the birth of Shem and the death of Solomon, and it's also the time from the birth of Arpachshad to the reign of Jehoash, and so on, all these different things, from the death of Noah to the death of Cyrus, all these different relations, these time periods are all 2401 or close to it. These are all BCE dates, aren't they? No, here's some CE dates. Hang on a second. Wait a minute. What's this? Yeah. No, they're not. Yeah, that's right. The left-hand column are all BCE dates, and the right-hand column becomes the common era right at the point of the Apostolic Council in 48 CE, the first time that date becomes the common era, and then from then on it's the common era, not before the common era, on the right-hand column there. Okay. But there, you can read that. It's just a little summary there of all the dates. I'm sure it's not all of the examples. It's all the ones that I could come up with at the time I made the table, which would be correlated by this time period of 2401 years. So that's it for that study for today. What was I thinking? I'm sleep deprived today, where I wasn't. Today I'm really, you can tell the difference in how well I'm performing because I'm sleep deprived. I didn't sleep well, and part of the reason is because I'm worried about my car, the new battery. It's charging really, really well, I think, but it's being charged very slowly, using a float voltage of 13.2 volts, but the current has dropped to below, what was it? Below 0.0, I can look it up. It's 0.03 or something, 0.04 or whatever it was. It dropped by, I calculated, a factor of about 7 below the 0.26 or 0.27 that I used to have. So it's way down. And that means, and also the voltage drop across the battery itself while I'm charging it at 13.2 is 13.17, I think, now. Yeah, that's about right. So it's getting very close to the same voltage as what it's being charged at. And that's why the current is so low, of course, across it. It's almost the same voltage that's being put into it as is appearing across it. And the difference is accounted for because there's some kind of internal activity there in the charging process still going on. But it seems to be charging, very well. But my worry is not the battery so much, although that's always a worry to some degree. Since it's a brand new battery, I don't know how good the condition is. I mean, it's always not good if it's not fully charged when you get it. And these batteries, they can be very, very close to the right voltage, and yet they're not nearly 100% charged because they're lead acid batteries. And 12.4 is a very, it's not far from fully charged for a battery that's supposed to be 12.6 or 12.8 fully charged. 12.4 is what it was when I got it. which I immediately measured as soon as I got it. So that's what it really was, 12.4. But, I mean, that's what it was at the time I got it. And that suggests it had been left sitting for a while after being fully charged. That's one possible explanation for why it was at that level. Now, 12.4 sounds like it's pretty good. And yet, you can look it up in a table and see that, you know, it's actually not anywhere close to 100% charged. But it's also not as low as 50%, you know. It's not too bad in that sense. I got a table, but I don't think I can produce it right now quickly. I don't know. Wait a minute, maybe I do know where it is. Let's see. Yeah, I want to show, but I just don't know where. I think I do know where it is, actually. Where is it? Oh, yeah, I remember. Sort of. Let's see. No, I have to find the... There it is. Yeah, state of charge. State of charge for AGM batteries. Now, this may not even apply to the particular battery of which I'm in possession, but it shows here. If 100% is 12.5... Wait a minute now. There we go. That's under discharge. This is in the open circuit voltage. Okay, so 100% an AGM battery is 12.85. That sounds about right. Okay. That'll be the high end. You know, 12.85 is the maximum it would be. If it's 75% charged, it will be 12.55. 50% charged is 12.25. So 12.4 is where mine was, and that's not good because it's between 50% and 75% charged. And they say if it goes below 12.4 for any length of time, it can get sulfation, which is very bad. It's undesirable. So the state of charge of it was not perfect, let's say, you know, when I got it, but certainly wasn't terribly negative either, or terribly bad, but not as good as you might think. And these lead acid batteries are very much trickier than you think, very much more temperamental, and you have to be, it's always good to keep them fully charged. And the worry that I have, though, is not because of so much of that. It's the fact that my car had this other battery that failed, and the battery that failed, I wasn't measuring it every day to do a test every time I drove it. I didn't test the battery each time, which I probably should have, now I realize. So I didn't know what the state of the battery was at the time it failed. I don't know. Therefore, I don't have any inkling what caused it, whether it was the battery itself or whether there's something wrong with the car or whether it was sabotage or, you know, or foul play, I mean, or whatever. I don't know anything about what caused anything. Other, you know, you get an idea. You never usually know much, but I know far more than I used to know because I always monitor the voltage. So I know exactly when it failed. I know what it was just before it failed, in terms of what the voltage was on it, which was lower than normal when I first or last started it successfully. 12.7 was much lower. This is a regular flooded battery, which is normally above, way above 12.7. It can be as high as, well, I guess once you take the float, or once you take the surplus charge off it, it drops much, you know, quite a bit to 12 point whatever. I guess 12.8 is normal for that battery, or maybe it's higher. I think it's about, well, I know when I'm starting them, they're often 13.3 because I've just They've just had a float voltage of 13.6 a few seconds before, you know. I just take the charger off it, and then I start the car. It's got 13 point some volts on it, but of course that's going to be not really 13.3. It's going to be a lead acid battery once you get the extra surplus charge off of it. It's going to drop to about 12.9 or 12.8. I'm not sure what the number is for a flooded battery now. I'm not even sure. Do they even say what it is? For a flooded battery? Well, I'm sure I can easily find that out, but... Okay, so now I'm transitioning from flooded battery to AGM. And AGM is an absorbent glass mat. AGM, which is identical in some ways to a lead acid battery. It's still a lead acid battery, but there's no liquid in it. So if it does get broken, there's no liquid to spill out, which is dangerous acid that would come out if it were a flooded battery. So I don't have to worry about that. And it's also not as heavy as the previous battery. If I'd gotten a lithium ion battery, it would have been way lighter. Right, and I can even buy one now that produces 800 cold cranking amps, but it has the wrong terminals on it, so I have to get terminal adapters. I looked for those, and it would cost about maybe $300, was it, or $300 or $400, I forget. Maybe about the same as the battery I bought, but the battery I bought is AGM, which is lead acid. The reason I went with lead acid is because they're better in the cold weather than lithium, for one thing. That's one reason. Lithium doesn't charge well in cold weather, doesn't perform well, unless you get the cold weather lithium. So, and also lithium can catch fire, and you sometimes hear about that. So you don't want a big, like even small lithium ion batteries in phones can catch fire, but if a phone catches fire, it's a smaller fire than if a big battery catches fire in your car, right? It could burn your car down to nothing. It's not a good thing to have a fire in your car or in your house or with a big battery on fire. So it's not a good thing to go with lithium unless you really are sure of the technology. It's just a little too early for me to adopt lithium for a car battery, but it would be the best because it would only weigh a few pounds, like maybe, 20 or 30 pounds lighter than the one I'm using with the new AGM even. The new AGM is about 30, it can't be 30 pounds lighter, so, but it could be 10 or 15 or 20 pounds lighter to get a lithium, which is handy because I could store it in the house, more easily move it in and out because it's lighter. I was storing my 37 pound battery in the house, and then I stopped doing that this summer, but I kept it charged while it was outside, and that it may have failed because of the summer heat, though, which was quite warm at the hottest time in the summer, which is not good for lead acid. Even AGM, they're not the best, but they're supposed to be more durable in heat and cold, better than the flooded batteries. So AGM, they're more vibration resistant. They're just supposed to be better. But I've heard they don't have as high of a cranking amperage, so they don't have as much power to start the car. They're not as, powerful, let's say. That's one thing about these AGMs. And if I wanted to, if I wanted a heavier battery, if I didn't mind the weight being more than 37, or I have 30 approximately, 31, I think, for the new one, the new AGM, if I got a blue AGM battery, the Optima Blue Top, that would be, I think, even more cold cranking amps, more powerful. It's the same technology, but it's a better, bigger battery, but it would weigh more. I think it even fits my car. I think I checked that, but it has to fit the car. It has to have the right terminals, has to have the right charging requirements for to work with your alternator in your car, if you want your car to be able to charge it. So all these, there's a lot, to buy a battery, it's a lot more than what you think. It's a lot more complicated than what you think. To choose a new battery, you can't just pick any battery. So I selected the battery after years of research, essentially. I did years of research before, in addition to the final decision, which was fairly quick, once I needed a new one. But, see, I'm worried more, not so much about the battery now, although that's another part of the worry. I'm worried about the new technology. How well is AGM going to work? Am I going to keep it in the house? I think I want to, because in the winter, it's just far better to keep things warm and then bring them out when you need them. Because I found the car would start like it was summertime. My previous car that I drove in the winter, which I don't have anymore, my Odyssey, it would start like a summer's day because the battery was warm. So it wasn't so much how warm the car was, although I would heat the block of the car if it were super cold. But if it's really cold or if it's too wintry, I can order food, have it delivered. I don't think I'll be driving in the winter unless the weather's good. But the worries that I have, there's so many worries, right, that they're all geared towards you know, preventing problems, really, and having the battery last a long time is one of the desirable things. You know, I don't know how long the new one's going to last, but the last one was a flooded battery, 4 years and 9 months. It's not bad, but considering how well I treated that battery, I expected to get a lot more out of it than that. But it depends on the quality of the manufacturing, and that was a ProPoint. I called it PowerPoint, but it was ProPoint. That battery was manufactured by ProPoint. I named it Pierre. He was called Pierre, that battery. So Pierre has exhausted his service life, but I may try and revive him along with two other batteries, one of which I'm almost certain is unrecoverable. The other one of which I named Marvin a long time ago, and he hasn't been in service, but he still produces or is capable of a couple of hundred cold cranking amps, but the car needs in the vicinity of, well, three times that or something, more than twice that to start the car. So I've got another hopefully much decent, you know, much closer to being perfect flooded battery as well that I don't use much, because I just didn't need to use her. And she's called Cecilia, that battery. That was the Accord's original battery for some time before I swapped the battery to put Pierre in there from the Odyssey, after I sold the Odyssey basically for parts and got a nice amount of cash for the 20-year-old car. Was it 20 years? Oh, three, yeah. 20-year-old car van that I decided to get rid of. And now I'm thinking I shouldn't have got rid of it. I should have kept it. Now I'm thinking, you know, because if one of my cars stops working, then to replace it, you know, to replace a car is a ton of money. And these new lithium cars, the new EVs, you know, they all require a 12-volt battery, which is ridiculous, isn't it? That they all require 12 volts to open the doors and things like that. You can't run these EVs without a 12-volt battery, so you're going to have the same issues with their 12-volt batteries, you know, quitting on you, with the EVs, just like you do with your standard combustion cars. I find that to be almost, well, completely unacceptable is what I would say. It's why can we not, if we have a battery based, you know, an EV, electric vehicle, why does it need a 12 volt battery in addition to the main battery? This shouldn't be like that, right? It should just have a way of protecting its own battery and the power in the battery that it has, or something. You know, it shouldn't be requiring an additional battery like that, because that's just an enormous additional bother And yet, that's the way they are. They all require these additional batteries. Some of them now are, I guess Tesla has come out with a different kind. They're using lithium now. And the voltage is too high for it to be jumped. You know, you can't jump it using a standard lead-acid battery because the voltage of lithium is higher. So you can't, you know, there's a lot of problems, apparently, with the EVs, 12-volt batteries that they're using. It just sounds, it sounds to me that it's bad. You have to have a jumper pack, for one thing. I've got a jumper pack, and I don't know if my jumper pack works now because it failed the last time when my battery quit completely. Couldn't use my jumper pack. It didn't work. So I don't know what I did, if I did something wrong with the jumper pack or what. I don't think so, but I think it was just that the battery was so dead that the jumper pack could not work. But I see, my worry is maybe there's something wrong with the car that's causing it to draw more current from the battery. If that's true, well, then, but then the boost, of course, worked. When I got a boost from a fellow motorist who happened to be there and helped me, when I got that boost, that started the car, but it wasn't easy because my battery was so dead. We had to wait a while for the battery to come up a little bit in voltage before I could even boost it. Maybe you need heavy leads on your booster cables, too, so that the voltage doesn't drop by the time the current flows from one battery to the next. You don't want to lose any of that voltage. That's important. So the heavier the lead, the less the voltage drop. I don't think the leads were as heavy as they could have been. Maybe that was part of it. But we did. It boosted, and once it boosted, the car ran, so that it's like the engine works fine. But how am I going to know that putting a new battery in it is not going to ruin the new battery trying to start the car? That's what I don't know. But, of course, it didn't have a problem starting off the boost, so maybe it's fine. But, I mean, the thing is, how do you test that? Is what I'm trying to figure out before I put a new battery in it. Of course, I have an older battery that I could try that's in perfect condition, or sort of perfect, almost perfect, as far as I know. Condition, maybe I should try that one first so that I don't burn out the new one. But, I mean, it's such a big worry. And maybe I should get another car. But then I have to winterize the one car every time, you know. So that's it for today. It's October 11th, 2024 of the Common Era. The time is 16:46 hours. North American Eastern Daylight Time. I'm Ward Green. Thank you for listening and watching. I'm glad you were with us. I love you very much. And in my behalf, this is Liv Dusty and this is Cassie saying bye for now. That was Arkabirartu, Chapter 4, Paragraph 2. And a lot of other battery-related information.